Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our multi-county listening area in central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, here with my co-host, Amelia Sorensen. Hello, Amelia.
Hello, Susan. Hello to you, a listener. Thanks for joining us. I am especially pleased to be able to greet you because I am new to the KHOI and to Iowa as well.
Yes, and you are actually also new to the U.S. since you arrived from Denmark only a couple of weeks ago. I think our listeners would be interested in the reason you came to Nevada, as well as a little about what you plan to do for the 3 months you are going to stay. You aren't in school here, are you?
No, I just graduated this summer in Denmark, now I'm here for 3 months. It's very common to, like, take a year off after gymnasium, and I want to experience the American culture. And my mom was here for an exchange student, as an exchange student 25 years ago. So I'm living at her host sister's place right now. And I got to experience my first football game in Haunted Forest. And 2 days ago, I experienced the interview with Liz Lidget, who are the curator of the art collection in South Story Bank and Trust in Huxley. And we'll hear about that later.
And now that we've introduced our co-host for today, it's time to turn to our action-packed program. The first half of the program will deal with art, some of which Amelie mentioned. But in the latter half, we will have an interview with George Gridel, who will be presenting the art and artifice of audiobook narration and will be at the library tonight and this afternoon. And we'll have an interview with Kristen Hawks, who will be speaking at ISU this evening about the grandmother hypothesis.
Oh, it all sounds interesting, but I'm particularly eager to hear the very first interview with Priscilla Sage. I saw the exhibit at the Octagon, and I'm excited to be able to hear from the artist.
And I'm sure you won't be disappointed. Before the 50th anniversary exhibit at the Octagon is taken down this weekend, we want to highlight one of the Octagon's founders, Priscilla Sage, who is also the artist featured in the current exhibit at the Octagon Community Gallery on Douglas Avenue, next to the Octagon shop. Before the show closes on October 29th, we just have time to bring you an interview that Priscilla had with Carol Horowitz, host of KHOI Previews the Arts, which normally airs at noon and 7 on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month. Let's listen in as Carol talks with Priscilla Sage.
My guest today is renowned fiber artist, retired ISU professor of art and design, and the co-founder of the Octagon Center for the Arts, Priscilla Sage. And thank you, Priscilla, for being with me today on Local Talk. Art has been a major part of your life, and it started when you were very young. You want to share some of that with us?
Well, it did. I just don't know how to do anything else. But when I was a child, I loved art, and my parents encouraged me to build things and to paint and so on. And they sent me to art school when I was 9. It was art school for adults, but I loved it, and I spent...
But they accepted you. Obviously, there was talent.
Well, it was all day on Saturdays, and there was an expert artist who put their canvases up in front of the group and told us how to paint what they had painted. It was just not really good child art as I taught it later on. But I learned a lot, and I loved it. I was very good at copying.
Well, it stayed with you, and how lucky we are that it has. But one of the things about you is the background, your family background is so interesting because you come from art roots. Is that right?
Well, this is true. And I also grew up in eastern Pennsylvania, where the Pennsylvania Germans who lived there painted everything. They painted hex signs on their barns. They painted distal things on their chairs and their trunks and so on. And yes, my grandmother was an artist. She painted. She went to college. She was a very fortunate woman. She went to college, and she painted. And then when she had 4 children, she quilted, as had been the family tradition, because fibers don't hurt kids. And
so did you see and watch? Were you Did you see her create?
Oh, I saw the quilt frame up in her dining room in the wintertime. Yes, I did. And she was very, you know, all the adults in my life thought everything I did was so wonderful, so I was praised beyond. But my grandmother did have some critical comments, and in retrospect, I value that. And she also gave me her paint box. I have her paint box, her little tin paint box.
So that's something that you keep as
memory. So in that environment, art was wonderful. It was always encouraged and people loved it. And it wasn't just my family. It was an environment where art was very accepted.
Yeah. Well, so as a child, a very young child, you attended adult art school.
Yes.
And then through college as well. Tell us a little bit about the people who made Priscilla Sage happen in terms of art.
Well, you know, no one knows when they go to college who you're going to study with. You really don't know where you're going. I knew I was going to study art and art education, but I went to Penn State, and at that time, there was a man called Victor Lowenfeld, who was head of the art education department, and he had come in the 30s from Vienna. And he had a very deep philosophy about child psychology and child art. And he was a very powerful influence on me. He had a philosophy that each person, first of all, I have to tell you, my first protest anywhere was because Victor Lowenfeld said the local grocery store is giving away coloring books, and coloring books are bad. So we have to picket the coloring books. So we picketed the coloring books. Excuse me. He was very influential in his
now,
philosophy.
Was he a professor who taught you in his classroom, or was he chair of the department?
All of the above. He was chair of the department. Excuse me. He was chairman of the department. He taught classes. I had a mural painting class with him. He taught, of course, a class on his book. He wrote a book. He's a professor.
It was just happenstance that you went Penn State when this remarkable gentleman was there. And so, added more to your background and your art.
Yes.
And so then off to grad school, is that right?
Well, then I got a job teaching in New Jersey. And that was right outside of New York City. So, in fact, there were all the places in New York City where I could study. So I went to Columbia for graduate school.
And so you were teaching school and went to graduate school at the same time?
Exactly. Teaching during the day and going to school at night.
And you told me something that I think is wonderful and very interesting, because you were a pioneer, I think, and maybe you'll correct me, in fiber art. I don't think when you were in graduate school or teaching art at in the New Jersey schools that fiber art was something that was recognized as a major art form. You told me the story about how you got involved with fiber art, because you are a renowned fiber artist. Your work is nationally, maybe internationally, presented. So tell us, how did that happen?
Well, besides the fact that the women in my family were quilters and did a lot of things with fibers, I decided that my children, this is elementary art in West Orange, New Jersey, that we would do a project with fabrics and yarns. And so I asked the children to collect yarns and fabrics. Little did I know, they had aunts and uncles who worked in New York City. I had one child whose aunt was in the hat district. In those days, there was a whole street for just making hats. In came beautiful velours and Tuscan straws and findings for hats. We had furriers. Furs came in. There was somebody who worked at Sloan & Company, and they brought in gorgeous silks and linen fabrics that were used for upholstery and curtains and so on. So the parents just backed their cars up to the loading dock and unloaded this stuff.
So what were you going to create?
Well, the children were going to use this to create fabric pictures and so on.
So collage?
Yeah. And I thought, well, goodness sakes, I would like some of this too. So I just collected some for myself and took it home. And I did my first fiber piece, which is in the collection of Iowa State University now. My very first piece. It was done in 1959.
Well, then after your opportunity to teach in the New Jersey schools and your graduate degree, you came to Ames with your husband for his career.
I did. I followed Charles to Ames. I thought I was coming to Iowa City because they had an excellent program that I was interested in. But lo and behold, I was in Ames. And the program here did not fit my interests. So I just used our second bedroom to start doing my own work.
Yeah, and you said you didn't know anybody at that time, and so you just had the time to create.
And I didn't have children. I didn't know anyone,
yet.
And I didn't have children yet. But that was still a couple years away. That was still
and so
several
you
years
away. so you created here in Ames, and then you became friends with you accrued a wonderful coterie of buddies and friends, and then what happened is that some of those friends, artists, thought that we needed some place for the art community and to show art. And you and three other women, what did you do?
Well, we were friends, and there was a great need for visual arts in this community at that time. And people were hungry for the visual arts, but there was not much happening. And so because we were friends and because we talked on the phone
and
a lot.
And that was Veronica Rudenberg.
And Martha Benson.
And Martha Benson.
And Janet Squires, who was instrumental in finding the place and getting membership and so on. We decided that we would start an art center. Now, someone recently asked me, they said, well, it takes a long time to plan to start an organization. And I said, no, we did it on potlucks and telephone calls. We did not have a committee. We just decided that this town needed an art organization.
And that
like
was
this.
50 years ago.
Yes.
And the Octagon is celebrating its 50th anniversary. And I will tell you that you better hurry because October 29th, which is Saturday, Priscilla, the founder's art exhibit, is going to close. And you've got to go and see the exhibit that's at the Octagon, 427 Douglas Avenue, because you will see wonderful art from the women who started the founders and of the Octagon 50 years ago. And Priscilla is a very active artist and continues to be a very active artist. But you will be very, very pleased and impressed with the art at the Founders Exhibit, and that closes on Saturday. So this very Saturday, October 29th. So you want to go to that. And if you want information about the exhibit or hours of that the Octagon is open, you can call 515-232-5331. 515-232-5331. And so I'm going to go back to your career, Priscilla, because your art is exhibited in permanent collection. I mean, you have permanent collection. Tell us about the Paducah, Kentucky situation, how did that happen, and what is there?
Well, that was just about 3 years ago. I was invited to exhibit my work at the National Quilt Museum in Paducah, Kentucky. And I will tell you, in 1960, when I started working, the idea that I would be in a quilt museum was quite beyond me, because a lot has happened in 50 years.
So Paducah is known for?
Oh, it's a beautiful museum, and it has a fabulous collection. And so I had my work there. I was invited to show quite a bit of work. I probably had 15 sculptures there. And now I am in their permanent collection. And what I'm so pleased about is my work is really sculpture, but my technique technically would be quilting because it's a sandwich of fabrics that's then stitched together. And so they accepted that in their museum, but I'm the only three-dimensional artist there. I mean, the only sculptor in that collection.
And
so I was quite pleased about that.
Well, one of the things that is so outstanding when we see a Priscilla Sage art exhibit is how outstanding your works are. You work with mylar. How did that happen?
Well, my work has grown by inches through many years, and I would say through more than 50 years. And I started out doing wall pieces that involved a lot of stitching and texture. And gradually my work came off the wall. I mean, I just developed techniques so that it came off the wall, and eventually it became entirely three-dimensional in sculpture.
But the mylar?
The mylar came through the 70s. There was a lot of shiny synthetic fabrics in the 70s, and that's when the mylar was discovered. Actually, late in the 70s, I was using this silver fabric, and I had a technique where I had dispersed dyes, which were dyes that were painted on paper, and heat transferred to the mylar fabric. And the mylar fabric really received it beautifully, and the iridescence of the colors was just exquisite at that time. So that is really, there was a blending of the silver fabric and the dyes that I was able to use to achieve that effect.
Well, I mean, there's no question when you go to an exhibit, wherever you go, to in Des Moines or in Paducah, and you see an exhibit and you say, that's a Priscilla Sage. It's so unique and so outstanding. But I'm going to go back to the Founders exhibit, because the Founders exhibit, it's on the main, your art is on the main floor, the main gallery, and it's just breathtaking, and we can look in the window. But go ahead, go in, because you can go in and see it at 427 Douglas Avenue. I'm just going to throw in one thing that we have been friends for a lot of years, and I was privileged to be invited to join your late mom and your niece and you, and we all went to Waterloo. Why did we go to Waterloo?
Well, this was the late 80s, early 90s. I gave a lecture at the Waterloo Art Center, and I made a glib comment about I always wanted to have an exhibit with my grandmother, because she was an artist and she also made quilts. And so Clarence Olling, who was the director there, said when I was finished with this lecture, he said, I'll do the exhibit. So Clarence did the exhibit of, it turned out to be four generations of women in our family. And I had my mother was still alive at that time. I had a wonderful time researching this, figuring out who did what in terms of the quilts, because sometimes the tops were made and they weren't finished or they weren't quilted. And so, the whole purpose of that exhibit though was making a comment about women, because women's quilts were not accepted as art. And so it was really the fact that women were doing this work, and that it was artwork. It was more than keeping a bed warm.
I was privileged, and those who saw that exhibit had that privilege. Well, I have to thank you so much, Priscilla, for doing this with me. I am Carol Horowitz, and I have had the pleasure of interviewing Priscilla Sage, our very, very wonderful artist. How lucky we are to have you in our community. And I'm going to turn this over to Susan and Local Talk.
Thank you to Carol Horowitz, host of KHOI Previews the Arts, for bringing Local Talk her interview with Priscilla Sage. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames, and the surrounding area. Your hosts today are Susan Franzen and Amelia Sorensen. We've been talking about the artists whose show at the Octagon Community Gallery just across the street from KHOI will be on display only until Saturday, October 29th. So there's not a lot of time to get down there and see it. And Amelia and I saw it together the other day, and what did you think about it, Amelia?
Oh, it was really fun, and it was nice art, and yeah, we just had a great time there. It's a nice place.
And now we're turning to an art collection in Huxley at the newly built South Story Bank. From the curator, Liz Lidgett, we learned more about this display, and we will also find a little about the philosophy of the bankers who are bringing significant works of art into their bank buildings.
Yeah, it was really fun to listen to the interview as you recorded it. Let's share it with our listeners.
I'm speaking with Liz Lidgett. Where are you working right now?
I am working from my office right now at my home office.
Where is your home office?
I work out of Des Moines.
And how did the Garths find out about you to curate the art in the Huxley Bank?
I was contacted probably a year and a half ago. They had seen some of my work that I had done other locations and asked me to submit an RFP. And I was able to meet with them and with the South Story Bank folks and to show them kind of my ideas for the space. And luckily, we were on the same page, and I was really thrilled to be able to get the job and work with them.
Now, how many pieces of art did you find locations for in the bank?
We ended up buying and finding locations for about 40 to 50 pieces of artwork. So it's a kind of an amazing thing. The Garst family are so committed to the arts and to the community, and they really wanted to show that by working with local artists and finding a lot of locations within the bank, both up above and down below, and then also in their everybody's offices, and then to do a public piece of artwork as well outside of the bank. So it was, we were trying to incorporate art into the bank as much as possible.
Well, I believe I heard that the piece of art outside the bank was commissioned.
It was commissioned, yes. So we wanted to give a nod to the fact that Huxley is known for its prairie grass. And so the artist, John Brommel, created 20-foot-high statue of prairie grass. And I really love it. It's so beautiful. And when there's a little bit of wind, it almost looks like the sculpture is kind of swaying in the wind. It's very secure and safe, but it gives this gorgeous ephemeral feel to the piece, almost like it's growing and living grass.
Sounds extremely interesting. And you mentioned that the Garsts were committed to art. Have you done art for any of their other banks?
I am working on another bank of theirs in Perry, Iowa right now. But even the banks that I have not worked with, almost every bank that I have taken and visited and seen of theirs always has artwork of some kind. So it's clearly something that they are very committed to. For the South Story Bank in particular, I came up with the idea and proposed the idea of working with artists that were along the cultivation corridor. And that is a phrase that was coined a couple of years ago just to talk about the area from Des Moines to Ames and really being able to connect that space, especially in the tech world. But I was interested in looking at it through the art world and to work with artists that were from that cultivation corridor. Of course, Huxley is right along that way as well, right between Des Moines and Ames. So it seemed like the kind of perfect idea to be able to work with their clients, with their employees, and with artists around the area.
When you select works, do you have any idea whether these artists are up and coming? For example, I talked to another banker about art in banks. And he said, well, there's another way to look at it. This is an investment because some of these artworks may be considerably more valuable in future years.
You know, that's kind of a tricky subject, honestly. My number one piece of advice when I'm helping clients buy artwork is that they need to absolutely love it. That's the number one thing that I want them to be focusing on. Certainly from the bank world, there is that way of looking at it as an investment piece. Certainly there are more up-and-coming artists in the area, and the Iowa art scene is growing nonstop. And we really wanted to be able to work with more established artists and more up-and-coming artists and do a great mix of that. The investment piece is always tricky, though, because you don't know how it's going to be in 3 to 5 years. I wish I had the magic ball that really could tell what was going to be a great investment piece. But I think the number one thing is that they find artwork that they truly love. And so if it does go up in value, that's wonderful. But either way, they have work that they really love and cherish.
Now, they have also a space for local artists, I've been told.
Yes, they do.
How is that incorporated in your overall plan? Is it a sort of a room out of the way, or is it can you see the other art from that area?
The community art wall is right in the main lobby, and I think it works very well with the rest of the artwork because this is also artwork coming from that area. We have had a variety of different types of artists there. We've had everything from up-and-coming artists to artists that are showing for the very first time and giving them that opportunity to working with local schools and the students who are artists and showing their work there for a limited time. So I think it's really exciting because while there's so much incredible artwork in that building, we have this space now for community members to be able to show their work, to be able to show exactly clientele from Huxley, to work with their children from Huxley, to show exactly what's going on in that particular art scene. And that there's something always constantly changing so that clients can come in every single time and see something different.
Well, now, do you maintain your relationship as curator with the local exhibits?
No, I don't take a part in those. They work on those internally. I help them set up the parameters and how to start the program, but they've been able to work with people locally there, which is wonderful. And what we did that was really, really great, I think, is that we put in a system of hanging for artwork so that it can be adjusted. So no matter what type of artwork they're showing that particular month, they're able to use the same wall, the same system to be able to hang it and show it off in different ways.
Now, when I looked at your website, I could see that your personal story has grown beyond the Central Iowa region. Could you tell us a little about what your business is like?
Sure. So my company, Adore Your Walls, is an online art advisory website. So people can go on and buy an affordable art advisory package, depending on their room and depending on how many pieces of artwork they need. Once they buy a package, they can take a questionnaire that has about 10 or 15 questions, and that ranges from everything from what type of style is your home to what do you do on a Saturday afternoon. So that kind of information helps me find the right piece and the right style for the client. And then they can also upload photos and dimensions of their space. So I don't have to be physically there to know exactly what type of artwork or what size of artwork they would need. From all of that information, I put together suggestions for art for their home and help them buy it. So really, I believe that people sometimes need help with their artwork. I want to be able to do that. I want to help people be proud of their homes. I want them to be able to have artwork that they can afford. You don't have to be a millionaire to own an art collection and be really proud of their space. So that's really what Adore Your Walls does. We help people find artwork depending on their style, space, and budget.
And I presume that they have a a selection to choose from so that they can find something that they really do love.
Exactly. So from all of that information, I send over suggestions and artist objectives. So I go back and forth. We do edits. A lot of the time, it just takes one, which is really fun and that I was able to nail exactly what they were looking for. But if it's not exactly what they're looking for, I take those suggestions and send them back edits. So we're able to find something that they truly want to live with and love.
Now, I heard someplace that you've done a lot of banks. So is this outside Iowa?
Most of the banks, or almost all of the banks that I have worked with, are throughout central Iowa. So I have done some banks. I've also done restaurants, corporations, people's homes. So it really goes a wide array of the different type of clientele we work with.
So I presume that in central Iowa, you actually can visit all of the places that of your clientele.
Yes, exactly. When I'm working with businesses, I almost always am working with them on a basis where I'm able to go into their space and see it. The homes that through Adore Your Walls and through the website is what makes it able to do it virtually. But for the clientele here locally, I always go and see their space.
Oh, are you an artist?
You know, I love to create, but I don't sell my work. It's just for our home.
But you understand at least one medium, right?
Well, you know, I work with a wide variety of mediums. So I work with painters, with sculptors, with print artists, with etching, with letterpress. I mean, I do a whole wide variety. So I work with a large variety of mediums and with artists. My background is in art history. So even though I'm not creating it, I certainly understand how it's created.
Is there anything you'd like to tell us that I haven't asked you about?
I think that's it.
Well, thank you so much for this very interesting picture of how art can enrich our lives right here in central Iowa, local art, and expect to be able to walk into banks and other businesses and be greeted by some really significant art.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Goodbye, Liz.
Bye-bye.
That was Liz Lidgett, curator of the art collection in the South Story Bank and Trust in Huxley. In case you just tuned in, this is Local Talk, Community Radio, Story City, Ames, and the surrounding area. And now we will hear from two speakers who will be lecturing today in Ames. The first is George Guidall, actor and acclaimed narrator of over 900 audiobooks. George Guidall, who will be presenting the art and artifice of audiobook narration at the Ames Public Library at 2 p.m. and again at 7 p.m. Not the same presentation both times. You'll hear about that in a minute. Local Talk reporter Kay Puttock recorded this interview with Mr. Guidall. The interview gives a small taste of what people can look forward to during the library presentations today.
This is one of the most exciting parts of my career as an audiobook narrator. I've now recorded about 1,347 books in about 20 years, and I've come to discover that the recorded book fills a very essential part of a person's life. Everyone needs to have a narrative inside them. Everyone talks, you get movies, you get books. There's always a story being told. And if no one is talking to us and if we don't see a story, we end up talking to ourselves because we have to have that narrative. When the listener of an audiobook listens to a recording, they have a very vicarious experience of whatever the storyteller is putting forward. For instance, if it's a sad, dramatic novel, the intent for me, to satisfy the author's intent, is to convey that sadness to the listener, is to convey the nature of that experience to the listener who is there doing whatever they may be doing. I have many listeners not only driving, but some are weavers, knitters, uh-huh. Artists. I even have a dentist with favorite books of mine that his recurring clients like to listen to while he drills. it's a marvelous experience for mm-hmm. me because I get such a feedback from the listening audience that I've never gotten in the theater. I've been in the theater for, my God, 40-some-odd years, and I've gotten awards in the theater, and I've been back, people backstage come and they congratulate me, but nothing compares to what people in the audience of these shows get from me, because they've been listening to me for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
In a theater, somebody sees a good performance, and that lasts perhaps for a week or a month, maybe if you're lucky, or maybe a few months, but after a while it fades away. But once a listener gets a connection to the audiobook narrator, that connection is a very personal one. They feel comforted by that reader. They feel as if they know that reader. And you'll find that people go into libraries and say, I want a book by, and they'll say the name of the narrator, not the author. Because the narrator has given them a kind of feeling that they, the two of them, the listener and the narrator, have come across an experience together and have experienced it together. And that's the most important part of a good recorded book for someone.
Now, you seem to be saying very clearly, I think, that when people listen to you narrating a book, they can get much more out of it than they would if they just sat reading it by themselves. Now, of course, they can listen at a time when they couldn't read, as you mentioned, when they're driving and drilling people's teeth and so on. But there's also, it seems to be, that people can get something they couldn't get by reading by themselves. Have you had that?
That's a wonderful question, and many people have said that. I can't listen to a book. I have to have it in my hand. I have to read it. Well, it's a different experience. It's not the same. And it can't. They can't compete. What the recording does is make that imagined truth that the narrator is conveying come to life. It gives it an immediacy, and it shares an emotional vibrancy with the listener. When you read a book, the value of the book is still there. You read Les Misérables, and you feel for the Cosette and for Jean Valjean, and you admire Hugo's writing, but when you hear it, you are there when it's happening.
Right.
You don't have to work intellectually to appreciate the nature of the experience. You're lying back and you're listening to someone tell you as if it's happening now, which is the value of the whole experience. Someone wrote me a letter once and said that they like to read books and not listen to them, but he said he realized that the medium and the message combine to make something greater than the sum of its parts. And that's the best explanation I could ever have gotten, because it is the combination of both the words the author gives you and the nature of the experience
mm-hmm.
that makes it very, very, very significant.
Yeah, I've got a question about how you handle female voices. When you...
Yes, well,
you have got quite a deep voice.
I always have a pair of red pumps in the studio, and I just put them on, and it seems to work. No, I'm just kidding. It was a mistake. When I first started, I used to go up way up here and do all that kind of, and that's really...
That's a parody, really, yeah.
It's terribly stupid. And I was young, so I could be stupid then. What I do is just lessen the lower register.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I soften it up. I talk a little slower. But I have 50% of my work is done by the author when he says, she said.
Sure.
So she said, she implied, et cetera, et cetera. That's there. I do change the voice a little, but I don't ever try to sound like a woman. That's impossible.
Right.
Right.
Okay, well, it sounds if there's... I don't want to sort of spoil it for people who are be coming to your talk and question session at the library. So I just wanted to give them a taste. So let's remind people, this is today. It will be Wednesday, October the 26th at 2 and at 7 in the library auditorium, Ames Public Library, 515 Douglas. Thank you so much, Mr. Goodell.
My pleasure.
That was George Goodell, who was speaking with Kay Puttock about the experience of reading as well as listening to audiobooks. Also this evening at 6 p.m., there is a talk on campus that Greta Anderson has an interview to talk about with us.
And Greta Anderson happens to be in the studio behind the controls here as engineer. And yes, Kristen Hawkes stopped in last night after her flight and I think a brief dinner to preview for our listeners what the grandmother hypothesis is. And so here's our interview. I'm here with Kristen Hawkes, professor at the University of Utah in Salt Lake in the Department of Anthropology. She will be speaking tonight on the grandmother hypothesis and human evolution. We've been speaking, and she explained that the grandmother hypothesis, to some extent, replaces what she calls and what others call the hunting hypothesis. And so, to begin with, why don't we talk about the hunting hypothesis and then move into the grandmother hypothesis and how it differs. So the hunting hypothesis answers some of the questions about how humans differ from apes, their closest relatives. Mm-hmm. Take it away, Kristen.
Well, it has a long history, and it's very persuasive. Using lots of lines of evidence, what do we see in the archaeology? We see the stone tools and the bones of large animals. That looks like there must have been hunting in the past. We compare humans to our closest living relatives, the great apes, and whenever we see humans, actually whether they're hunting and gathering or not, we see these nuclear family units, which we do not see in the other apes, in which men and women pair. And we like to think that those units are families all with this common interest in which dad is often supporting wife and kids. Well, we don't see anything like that in the other great apes. There is no males supporting mates and offspring. So we've got hunting in the archaeology. We've got this difference between us and the other great apes. So the argument that the kind of climate change that was producing the savannas in ancient Africa meant that populations that were staying in those environments couldn't do as well on the kinds of foods that our closest relatives depend on, the fruits and leaves and stems in the forest. And if you were going to be in those open environments, hunting was a much better way to make a living. And that what was happening with the increasing animal populations taking advantage of the spreading grasslands. And if you hunt for a living, then that is an impetus to increasing brain size, because predators tend to have bigger brains than their prey. And associated with that is a longer period of dependence. So if mom is now having kids that are dependent longer, trying to hunt and worry about those kids is tricky trade-off. Better to pair with a hunting male who will then be the father of the children and will bring home the bacon to feed the wife and kids.
And this sounds a lot like the 50s.
Sounds so much like the way we think we were in the 50s. Leave it to Beaver. Does anybody remember that? Ozzie and Harriet.
Anyway. And so you and others have developed a grandmother hypothesis that contrasts with this, looks at slightly different things, and finds that the difference between humans and apes comes from a different kind of factor than this impetus to hunt and bring home the bacon, so to speak.
Yes. And in fact, our attention to grandmothers really came after things that we observed ethnographically that were working with hunter-gatherers that were challenging the hunting hypothesis. But when we started work with these hunter-gatherers in East Africa, we were not especially focused on the old ladies. We didn't have that idea at all. But because of the kind of data we were interested in taking to see how everybody of different ages and sexes spent their time, what emerged out of those observations was the economic importance of older women and the crucial role that they played in subsidizing the weaned children of women who had just had another baby. So a kind of resource that was really continues to be really important to these folks is one that little kids really have a lot of trouble with.
And what is that?
And that is this tuber. It's like a potato, but these are, they're really enormous. And the plants like to put the nutrients in these swelling roots deeply underground. So to get to them, you have to dig. And that takes the kind of strength that little kids don't have. Little kids are amazingly active foragers among the Hadza, and they try, but their efficiency at this is very low. So they depend on their mothers until she has a new baby, and then they depend on their grandmother. So there that was. And at the same time, we were, of course, seeing what was going on with the hunting, men specializing in these very big animals. And because they were specializing in these big animals, they were failing most of the time. In fact, you had to go, our data show, the average hunter, a month of days hunting to get one. The capture rate, aggressive scavenging and hunting, was only 3.5% per day. You know, you were almost assured of failure. And yet, this is what men spend their time doing, and they pass up alternative resources.
Well, they could be digging the tubers, too.
They could, exactly. Or they could be taking small animals. So we were seeing this was going on with the hunting, and then seeing that the daily problem of feeding the kids came from the work of women. And as we tried to look more closely at what they were doing, what began to emerge was, wow, these old ladies on this one particular resource especially, they spent more time at it than did the younger women, the one that really requires all this effort to dig the tubers. And they're there year-round. And then our data showed how the little kids would try, but their rates were not enough to feed themselves, that they depended on their moms, but then when mom had a new baby, their grandmother. So we saw this sort of division of labor between the post-fertile women and the fertile ones. So the trade-off was right there in front of us, that the kind of assistance for subsidizing those kids that was provided by the older women was what allowed women to space their births so closely. And one of the things that's really different, among the things that are really different between us and the other great apes, is the birth spacing. We have very close birth spacing. They don't. We have much longer lifespans and much later age at maturity than they do. And yet, in females, fertility ends at essentially the same age in all of us. And we now have models that, agent-based models that, so these are just models. They're not, we don't have a time machine. We can't go back and look. But we can build these little toy worlds in which we have life histories that are like the other great apes. And then we add this grandmothering thing. And what happens in the models is we go from a great ape life history, great ape-like life history, to a human-like one. And it is very striking. And at the human-like equilibrium, the fraction of adult women who are past their fertility looks like what we see in foraging, in humans who are foraging for a living. So the models are very seductive. They make it look like we're on the right track.
Well, just listening to you talk, we can hear the scientist in you. Of course, for our listeners, we're going to be thinking on the metaphorical lines of how important grandmothers are in our everyday life. And just before we close, I'd love to hear you say a few things about how this grandmother hypothesis has changed maybe how you look at the world around you.
Oh, I'm afraid I imagine a lot of the people listening to this are like this, but when I'm thinking about something, I begin to see it everywhere. And I would say there's no question that the role of older women is something that hasn't been given the kind of attention that the grandmother hypothesis suggests it certainly deserves.
Well, thank you so much for drawing our attention to it. Kristen Hawkes of the University of Utah Anthropology Department speaking tonight at Curtis Hall at 6 p.m.
Well, that was a very thought-provoking interview, I must say. Of course, while you're listening, you have to think about what your grandmothers did and what important parts of your life, or today perhaps not important, because this is a big change away from much of the past.
Yes, the you know, this is about evolution. She's looking at the evolution. How did humans evolve to be so different from apes? And the role of the grandmother, rather than the role of the male hunter, is the focus of this new line of research. And it's very fascinating to see all of the corollaries that come from that, the female-centric corollaries that come from that. And
but I think we should point out that time. A 6 p.m. Lecture is quite unusual.
Yeah, I think there's another lecture at 7 p.m., a different one on free trade somewhere else on campus, and the Iowa State Lecture Committee wanted to make sure that folks could attend both if they chose. So, yes, 6 p.m. in Curtis Hall is the time of the lecture.
And to bring this varied program to an end, I think that we need to have a little announcement about what's happening on Halloween, which is just around the corner, like at the end of the week, throughout central Iowa.
Yes, Halloween comes early in Ames.
Calling all Halloween fans, young and old, here is your central Iowa Halloween schedule. Trick-or-treating is happening in downtown Ames on Friday, October 28th. Downtown businesses are inviting you to this family-friendly event. Babies, toddlers, kids, and parents are all encouraged to dress up.
Downtown Trick-or-Treat in Nevada will be held on Thursday, October 27th, from 5 to 6:30 p.m. Business owners will be downtown to hand out goodies. Citywide Trick-or-Treat will be held on Monday, October 31st, from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. According to the City of Nevada, there are around 800 of you candy seekers there.
In Boone in Ogden, trick-or-treat night will be on Monday the 31st in downtown Ogden. You can participate in trunk-or-treat.
And Slater, trick-or-treat is on Monday, October 31st, from 6 to 8 p.m. Get your candy.
Trick-or-treat night in Huxley is scheduled for Monday, October 31st. According to the City of Huxley, all ghosts, goblins, creatures of the night will be free to roam the town in search of goodies from 6 to 7:30 p.m.
Madrid will have beggars' night on Sunday, due to a home football playoff game. There, you are encouraged to bring children to the Madrid home and the Cedars for Beggar's Night.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in central Iowa. We've been your hosts, Susan Franzen and Amelia Sorensen. We started out the show with Carol Horowitz interviewing Priscilla Sage. Then we spoke with Liz Lidgett, curator of art for the South Story Bank in Huxley. Kay Puttock brought us an interview with George Guidall, who will be presenting the art and artifice of audiobook narration at the Ames Public Library today. That's 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. Following will be Greta Anderson's interview with Kristen Hawks, telling us about the grandmother hypothesis. And then we had some Halloween voices telling us what's going on throughout central Iowa. One trick-or-treat.
Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Thanks to Ron Carson for taking care of the technical details of these posts with information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all of our show postings in your news feed.
Local Talk was engineered by Greta Anderson. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoifm.org.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
Funding for KHOI is made possible in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. In the heart of Ames, the Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun. Located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza, the Farmers Market provides fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment every Saturday.